So here we are, the second lecture in chapter 2. Chapter 2 is on the choices. And I'm going to pick up about midway into chapter 2, trying to finish this up today. And this is slide 13. It says, what is a danger in a pure democracy? And the danger in a pure democracy is that the majority can take everything away from the minority. See, because who wins in a democracy? Well, who wins in a democracy is majority of voters. So in a democracy, the majority can take everything away from the minority. Now, when we pledge allegiance to the flag, we say, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands. Now, we didn't say the word democracy, we say the word republic. So there's a difference between a republic and a democracy. Now, what a republic is a system based on law. And what is the purpose of many of the laws in at least our republic? Not all republics, but our republic in the United States is to protect the minority from the majority. So, see, and if you're going to understand our economic system, you're going to have a basic understanding of certain fundamentals that builds the system. And what we have in America is we've built a system whereby we've got two opposing forces here. Now, if you can see my hands, we have on one side, you've got democracy. And the other side, you've got the republic, which is the system based on law. Now, if this thing gets out of whack, then bad things happen. See, if the democracy is up here, where so many decisions are made by popular vote, then the danger is that the minority, whoever they are, can lose. Allow their possessions and allow their freedoms. But if you go the other way and you have a republic, now see what was the name of in Russia before the fall of the Soviet Union? You know, the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore, but the initials was USSR, which stood for the United Soviet Socialist Republic. Now, here's a country, a system based on law, but were there any freedoms under that system? And the answer is no. See, so a republic, if you have too much of a republic, like we did in the old Soviet Union, then what happens is that those who are in power can make the laws. Therefore, the average person could, as what happened in the old Soviet Union, the average person had very few freedom. So the average person, or many people, can lose their freedom and their livelihoods if this thing gets out of whack. If you got too much democracy in one hand, that's not good for society. If you got too much republic, and not enough democracy where people can't vote and influence those laws, then who's ever in power can make whatever laws they want. So what we have in the United States is sort of a balance between these two. See, we got democracy here, but then we got a republic here. And of course, life is a matter of change. Nothing stands still. And in some periods, maybe the democracy will supersede the influence of the republic, and maybe at other times the republic can supersede the influence of the democracy. But in a good, well-running system, you have this balance between the two, democracy on one hand and republic on the other. Anyway, that's if you understand that, you can understand better why we have the system we do. See, what are the main ideas of the Declaration of Independence? Our rights come from God, and that liberty is fragile. Now, in some systems, this is not part of their constitution, that rights come from government. But what the danger, if we believe that our rights come from government, then government, who's ever in charge of government, can take away those rights. But if we act and believe that our rights come from God, then government cannot take our rights away. And that's why our founding fathers that wrote the Constitution put in these words that our rights come from God and not from the government. See, what is the biggest threat to our freedom? And the biggest threat to our freedom is centralized power. You see, how is it that our Constitution protects our freedom? The way that our Constitution protects our freedom is that our Constitution allocates power amongst several agencies. See, the Constitution says, for example, the President of the United States has these powers. Congress has these powers. The Supreme Court has these powers. States have these powers. Localities have these powers. See the whole point to our Constitution is to make sure that power is not centralized. As long as we got a little bit over here and a little bit over here and a little bit over here, then if we can prevent power from becoming centralized, then that is the only way that the average person can enjoy a personal freedom. So if the Constitution protects us by separating power amongst different factors, then what is the biggest threat to our freedom? Well, the biggest threat to our freedom is the centralization of power. See, once power becomes centralized, then those who are in power can do what they want. And history has taught us that that will lead to the loss of most, if not all, personal freedom. Okay, so if you're going to analyze, oh, is this good or is this bad? These events that are occurring, what should I think about these things? Well, what you should do is that you should evaluate world events and events in America is this leading to a centralization of power, or is it leading to a diffusion of power? Because if it's leading to the centralization of power, then ultimately the average person is going to end up losing his or her freedom. What are the three branches of government? Okay, here's where power is decentralized amongst these different branches of government, according to our Constitution. What is the unofficial fourth branch of our political system? And that's the free press. See, as long as we have a free press, then we can read what the press tells us, and we can evaluate events. See, once power becomes centralized, what's one of the first things that would-be dictators do? Well, one of the first things would-be dictators do is that they take over the press. Because if you can control the press, you can control communication. You know, of course, it's more than the press. It's it would be television and the internet and all these other sources that we get our news. But if the government can take control over the news media, then it can control the minds of its citizens, and therefore it can consolidate power. See what I mean? So the fourth, you can look at our system as like a four-legged stool. You know, on one leg you've got the president, and then you've got the Congress, and then you've got the Supreme Court, and the fourth leg, even though it's unofficial, would be a free press. And that makes the essence of our political and economic system. Now, see, one thing you're going to learn about economics is that economics is a little bit of this and a little bit of that. You know, there's history in economics, there's sociology, you know, there's some mathematics, there's political science. See, all of these things from all these different disciplines come into play when we're trying to understand how our economic system works. See, because what is an economic system? A set of social institutions and mechanisms organized to answer three economic questions. Now, no matter what form of economic system that we live under, that any kind of economic system, whether it be a command system like you would have in, let's say, communism, or a free enterprise system, any type of economic system answers the same basic questions. And those questions is what, for whom, and how. In other words, what is a system going to produce? And then for whom is the system going to produce? And I mean, who gets what and how much? And how are we going to produce? I mean, do we produce through a command system, or do we produce through a free market? See, but no matter what kind of economic system that we have, every economic system has to answer these three questions. See, what is a command economy? An economic system characterized by public ownership of resources and centralized economic planning. See, a command system is where the government decides what is going to be produced. You know, in the old Soviet Union, now this is not true today in modern day, Russia. But back, you know, before the fall of the Soviet Union, there was a committee called Gosplan, and this is a group of people, and their responsibility was to determine what was going to be produced and how much was going to be produced in the whole, you might call it a country, but really it was more of a republic. It was an empire more than a country, because it made up of, you know, many, you know, previous countries made up the Soviet Union. And So we got, now imagine this. Imagine one group of people saying, in the next year, we are going to produce X pounds of nails, and we're going to produce so many doors, and we're going to produce so many door handles, and we're going to produce so many shoes, and, you know, so many of this, you know, this size shoe and that size shoe. I mean, imagine all these decisions of what are we going to produce made by a committee. I mean, that's mind-boggling. But see, that's the choice we have. I mean, either we let a free market decide what is going to be produced and who gets what and how much, or the other extreme is we have a central committee deciding what is going to be produced. Okay? And that's what's called a command system, when you have a central committee. Say, what is capitalism? An economic system characterized by private ownership of resources and the use of prices to coordinate economic activity in unregulated markets. Now, what we're going to learn here coming up is that even in a pure capitalistic system, we still need a strong central government for various reasons that I'm going to discuss here in a few minutes. But don't think that in a pure capitalistic system that means that we don't have any government, because that's not the case. We need a strong government for a variety of reasons. But what a pure capitalistic system would be that we do have private ownership, that people can own goods and that, you know, and the means of production, and they can buy and sell. I mean, that's what makes for private ownership. Resources, land, labor, capital, and entrepreneurship are the resources. And we use the price mechanism, to determine what the system produces and how much. And we talked about this earlier, what the price mechanism is. But what is an oligarchy? Power by a group dictates the rule of man. In oligarchy, decisions are centralized. See, when you have the extreme of a free market, when you have a centralized system, very rarely will you have one person that is in control. What you normally have is a group of people, and then that group of people have a representative that is recognized perhaps as the official leader. So when you have a group of people, when power becomes centralized in a group, then we call that an oligarchy. And that is the normal way that things are organized when power becomes centralized. Now, another type of system, or at least a variation of these type systems, is crony capitalism. So what is crony capitalism? A system where success in business depends on close relationships between big business and government. So in other words, you basically have a free market system, but you would have big business, and which controls most of the society's resources, and that big business and has a partnership with government. See, in other words, the people who are leaders in business then also become leaders in government, and leaders in government, when they retire from government service, they often get high-paying jobs in a big business. So you have this symbiotic relationship between big business on one hand and government employees on the other hand. And that's called crony capitalism. So that's a type of capitalism. Yes, basically it's capitalism where resources are privately owned and people have the freedom to buy and sell, but we call it crony capitalism because most of those resources are controlled by a small group, and that small group is in partnership with elected officials and government. Now, we've talked about these terms before, so I'm not going to belabor this, but in order to understand this, rent-seeking, businesses financially support politicians for the purpose of influencing legislation. See, okay, you got big business, and how do you nourish, how do you form that tight relationship between big business and government? Well, you hire lobbyists, and then you put money into politicians' campaigns, and therefore many politicians will make decisions based on their financial support. See, and we call this rent seeking. When companies put money in D.C. to influence legislation instead of money into making a better product, then we call that practice rent seeking. And rent-seeking leads to moral hazard. Occurs when businesses are insulated from risk and therefore are encouraged to take undue risk. When you have rent-seeking, where you've got this symbiotic relationship between government and business, then that often leads to moral hazard because businesses feel that or believe that no matter what they do or no matter what happens, that they will simply be bailed out by government if they get into trouble. Now, if you believe that no matter what you do, no matter how many risks that you take, that nothing bad's going to happen to you, that if you take big risks and all your investments lose money, well, you're not going to be hurt because the government's going to come along and give you money so that you're not hurt by your bad decisions. Now, when that happens, then we call that moral hazard. So rent-seeking leads to moral hazard, and moral hazard leads to unsound business decisions, which weakens the economy. At least it weakens the free market, for sure. And you all know by now that Adam Smith is known as the father of modern-day economics. He had the book published in 1776 called The Wealth of Nations, and so much of what we talk about here is taken directly from The Wealth of Nations, published way back in 1776. So a lot of these economic ideas, even though they may be new to you, are quite old and have been around for centuries. In fact, everything I've talked about so far is most of what I talked about you can glean right from The Wealth of Nations. Of course, if you read The Wealth of Nations, you're going to read Old English, and you know, in Old English, sentences can run for a couple pages, and that's very, you know, for modern people, it's very difficult reading. So what modern economics has done is that they've taken these basic ideas of Adam Smith and they put them into modern day lingo. And that's really a big part of what I do in this course. I just take these ideas and present them in modern terms and give you modern examples. But the basic ideas, you know, have been around for a long time. The understanding of basic principles. And we talked about this before, so this is just a bit of a review. But what role do prices play in a free market? See, we have a choice. See, the name of this chapter is Choices. Choices. We have a choice. Every society has a choice of either having our needs met through a command system or having our needs met through a free enterprise system. Now, if we have our needs met through a free enterprise system, then how is it that that businesses know, producers know, what we want? And the answer to that question is the price mechanism. The price mechanism in a free market conveys information. It gives incentives for the producer to give the consumer what the consumer wants. And through the profit motive, it gives the producer the financial ability to give the consumer what the consumer wants. So we have a command system on one hand, and we have a free market on the other hand via the price mechanism, prices. And what is a mixed economy? An economic system characterized by private ownership of some resources and public ownership of others. Some markets are regulated and others are not. So what do we have in the United States? Do we have a pure capitalistic system? No, we don't. In fact, no country in the world has a pure capitalistic system. Most countries have what is called a mixed capitalistic system, where part of that system is a free enterprise and a part of that system is more based on a command system. Now, here in later, you know, well, recent years, lately, more of our markets in the United States have been in a transition from a from a free market system to more of a command system. You know, our banking industry is based on more or less a command system. Our healthcare system is more or less a command system. Our education system is based on a command system. Okay? So we have what is called a mixed capitalistic economy. But the direction that we've headed, are heading to, is less and less of our system is free enterprise and more of it is based on the command system. Why have we modified the free market system? Now, here's where I talk about where even in a free market system, that does not mean that we don't have a strong central government. Okay, because a free market cannot provide us with everything we need. Okay? So let's look at the 8 basic goals of any system. Any system as a goal has to have growth. Now, the next chapter is about economic growth. And why do we give so much weight to economic growth? And the answer is very simple. And here's the answer. The answer is that because we live in a world where things wear out, now we live in a physical world, and in the physical world, things deteriorate. They wear out. Like, take your car, for example. I mean, every year you own your car, it deteriorates. You know, the brakes wear, the tires wear, you know, the muffler, I mean, you know, the body, it starts to, I mean, it you know, things deteriorate. Even if you didn't drive your car, let's say you just parked your car, well, it'll still deteriorate, because that's what time does to things. You know, if you let a car sit for too long, that, you know, the tires will dry rot, and, you know, the engine will freeze up. I mean, you know, it starts to rust. I mean, you know, no matter what you do, well, you know, things deteriorate. Therefore, if we don't grow, now what is growth, by the way? Well, growth means that, hey, we get something this year that we didn't have last year. And that's what growth is, right? I mean, if we produce a car, and we say, oh, okay, and someone buys that car, we say, oh, we've got a car here that's doing some good, that someone put a value on, society put a value on it. So that represents growth. We've got a car here that we didn't have last year. So that new car represents growth. Now, if we don't grow, do we have tomorrow what we have today? No, we have less tomorrow than we do today. Why? Well, because things deteriorate. Things wear out. If we don't grow, we don't stand still. We start to go backwards. You see, in life, we're either going forward or we're going backward. But we never stand still. And that is so true if you really understand how economics. We cannot stand still. Either we're going forward and things are getting better, or we're going backward and things are getting worse. Okay, so if we fail to grow fast enough, then we begin to digress, because the things that we have will deteriorate over time. Y'all with me on this? Okay, so that's why growth is so important. That's why I have a whole chapter on it. Full employment. Now, full employment should be a goal. That people who want a job ought to be able to get a job. Now, there are reasons why we can never have 0% unemployment, because we define the way we define employment or define unemployment. The way we defined it in economics is that if you're seeking gainful employment, then you're considered unemployed. Okay. Now, what groups are seeking employment even in the best of times? Well, you got high school graduates, college graduates, you know, young people like yourselves. You get to a certain age, what do? You start looking for a job. Well, is that bad? Oh, well, you're looking for work. Is that a bad thing? Well, no, that's just normal, right? So what we say in economics is that if maybe between 4 and 5% of the workforce is seeking employment, then we say, well, that's full employment. Now, no matter how you define full employment, that is a goal of any economic system, that we should strive to have full employment, whatever that means. See, the point I'm making here is you can define what full employment means different ways. But whatever, however you define it, then that, you know, that should be a goal of any economic system. And stable prices. Now, notice here, I'm not saying that prices don't change, because in order for the price mechanism to work in a free market system, prices have to fluctuate according to free market forces. Some prices will be going up according to market forces. Some prices will be going down according to market forces. But if we don't have wide swings and erratic swings, you know, or, you know, unexpected big changes, then that's what we call stable prices. So yes, prices are going to change, and in a free market, prices must change in order for the signals to be clear between producer and consumer. But we don't want wide swings. We want prices to be relatively stable. Okay, that you know, that should be a goal. And another goal is economic efficiency. Of course, economic efficiency is tied to growth. You know, the more efficient we are, and we talk a lot here about what that means, what productivity means, but if we're efficient, then that means that we can have more goods and services in the future, and the average person can enjoy a higher standard of living. See, that can only come about through greater economic efficiency. Okay, more economic efficiency, we produce more goods and services at lower costs, we can lower prices, and the average person can enjoy a higher standard of living than previously. That's economic efficiency. Another goal would be fairness. See, we whatever we do, we want things to be fair. Now, that doesn't mean that everyone has to be equal. Because in America, what's drawn so many people to America in the past is not an equality of income, but the realization that no matter where you are on the economic ladder, through hard work, you can climb up the ladder. See, that's what's made, you know, that's the reason why people flock to America. You know, it's not so much of our social programs; it's the economic freedom that America has offered in the past. Now, that's being watered down. You know, I think I mentioned to you before that America is not the leader in terms of economic freedom. In fact, we're about 12 or 13th on the list. But in the past, that's why so many people, and still do, they come to America for opportunity. Well, that's being fair. You know, fairness is, hey, here, you know, we're not necessarily going to give it to you, but we're going to give you the tools that if you're willing to put forth the effort and make the sacrifices, that anything is possible. That's fairness. Okay? And reduce negative externalities. Now, what is a negative externality? A negative externality is a negative byproduct of the industrial process. Like, we like the cars that Detroit makes, but we don't like the pollution that comes along with those cars. The pollution is what is called a negative externality. See, it's something that is external to the main purpose, and it's not good for society. It's negative. That's what we mean by negative. It's not good. And there's all kinds, and these are things that we'll look at in much more detail later on in the book and in the course. But one of the purposes of government is to reduce negative externalities. Okay? Say, you show me a business, a production business especially, you know, a business that produces things, an industrial business. You show me a business like that that has a social conscience. You know, where they say, well, we don't want to pollute. We don't want to run our waste into the river and put a bunch of the bad things up our smokestacks. Well, you show me a company like that, and I'll show you a company that will go bankrupt. That's not possible. It's not possible for a business to have a social conscience. How come? Because of competition. I mean, if all of us here were businesses that production businesses that can pollute, then if I develop a social conscience and I spend money minimizing my pollution, but you don't, your costs are going to be lower than my cost. Therefore, you can sell your product at a lower price than I can sell my product. And people are going to buy from you instead of buying from me. And in a matter of time, I'm going to go out of business. See, you show me a company that has a social conscience, and I'll show you a company that will ultimately go out of business. So, what's the solution to that? I mean, do we say, oh, well, just throw up our hands and say, well, I guess we're just going to have pollution? No, that's where government comes in. See, government comes in and says, well, you know, we're going to set standards that everyone has to abide by. See, if it weren't for government, we would all be choking to death from air pollution. All right? Because that's the way a free market would work. There's no incentive in a free market to have a clean environment. So we have to modify the system in order to give us things that a free market can't do all by itself. And, of course, another goal would be economic freedom. Economic freedom to buy and sell, to own private property, to determine what profession you're going to go into, to determine whether you're going to go to college or not, to determine what, if you do, you know, whatever you do, whether it be college or a trade school or whatever, that you make the decision of what you want to do, you know, for the rest of your life. That's called. And part of economic freedom, by the way, is also income. I mean, who has more freedom to do what they want to do, a rich person or a poor person? A rich person has more freedom, right? They have more choices. So part of economic freedom is that we have to have a system whereby the average person, see, can grow, can better himself, and can make an income whereby he can make good choices. So an economic system that grows, see, where we have an increase in productivity, whereby the buying power of the average person increases as a result of that growth, well, that also brings with it more economic freedom. It's got more, you know, a wealthy person has more economic freedom because they can make more choices. But if a system digresses, if a system does not grow and it shrinks, then what happens to the economic freedom for the average person? It lessens. It diminishes. Okay, so where are we going here? And security is another goal. That should be a basic goal that, you know, people ought to, you know that if they work 40 years, for example, that maybe they can retire and not live in poverty, that, you know, they can have more, you know, security in terms of food, clothing, and shelter. Now, that economic security, by the way, is greatly threatened in America. Why is it greatly threatened? Well, it's threatened, and I've mentioned this before, but, you know, I repeat myself on certain things just to reinforce it. But low interest rates has caused savers to put more money, I say less money, into savings accounts and more money into the stock market. So people who are in their prime earning years, that they're trying to build up a savings for, in order to have more economic security when they retire, see, they say, well, I'm not getting any return on my money in savings, so I'm going to put this money in the stock market. But what can happen if you've got your money in the stock market? Well, we can have a stock market crash. And then what happens to your economic security? Yeah. See, if you had your money in a good, if interest rates were higher, instead of interest rates being close to zero, let's say interest rates were 8, 9, percent, then people who put their money in savings, they're, you know, they would say, well, I know that I'm going to get an 8% return on my money. So the stock market can crash, but they're still going to get their 8% return because they didn't have all their money in the stock market. You know, they had their money in these, you know, savings accounts. But if they go from taking their money and put it in the savings accounts to putting money in the stock market, well, they might see big returns for a while, but if the market collapses, which it can overnight, then they lose all their economic security. Okay, so what is the most important goal? Because we live in this physical world, and this is what I just talked about, you know, growth. The most important goal is that we grow, that we encourage growth, so that things are getting better from day to day and year to year, and we're not digressing by having less and less because of deterioration, because things wear out from year to year. And what leads to growth? Well, this is the process that leads to growth. If we increase productivity, meaning that we can produce more goods per unit of time and a lower per unit cost, in other words, if our outputs exceed our inputs, okay, then that leads to a decrease that's what we mean by growth. Now, how do we attain that? Well, if businesses can lower costs, now, I've told you before that in economics, there's a difference between the terms cost and price. Cost is a business term. Price is a consumer term. Cost is what a business pays to produce something. Price is what you and I pay for the product at the store. All right? So if a business can decrease costs, then they can decrease their price. And if they decrease their price, they increase their sales. And if they increase their sales, they'll make more money. See, one of the wealthiest families in America is, the family that Walmart. Yes, Walmart. Now, what has made Walmart so successful? Well, does Walmart produce anything? No, they just simply buy wholesale and sell retail. You know, that's a most basic business practice. I mean, you know, most businesses do that, right? They buy wholesale and they sell retail. Well, that's all Walmart is. But Walmart has done it in ways that Sam Walton, who is the founder of Walmart, he was always looking for ways to lower his costs. Always. He was a driven man. I mean, read his biography. It's really fascinating. But he's just a driven man. His whole life was based on, at least his business life, which really was most his life, because he was consumed. But it was to lower costs. So what has made Walmart successful? Low prices, correct? Low prices. Well, how can they buy wholesale and sell retail at such low prices? Because they have lowered their costs. So the name of the game in business to succeed is lower your costs and then lower your prices, because lower prices lead to higher profits. Now, lower prices can only lead to higher profits if you have lowered your costs first. See what I mean? But if you lower your costs and then you lower your price, then because your sales will increase so much, you will increase your profits. In the meantime, however, what happens to the average person's standard of living? Well, as prices go down, what happens to our buying power? It goes up, right? We can buy more at lower prices than at higher prices. So it's a win-win situation. Everybody wins. Costs go down, prices come down, profits go up, people's incomes go up, their standard of living improves, and everyone benefits. In fact, even the government benefits because their tax revenues increase as the economy grows. But unfortunately, the opposite is true. What's the opposite? Well, the opposite is if our costs increase instead of decrease, then everyone suffers. See, increased costs lead to lower profits. Lower profits means less income for the average person, fewer jobs, tax revenues go down. See, everyone loses when costs increase. Everyone gains when costs decrease. You know, very few times is it really an absolute, you know, where you can say, well, this is an absolute statement. But that's pretty as close as an absolute statement as I think I can make. If costs go down, prices go down, sales increase, profits increase, people's incomes increase, government gets more revenue, everyone benefits. But if costs increase, everyone loses. Okay. What two opinions concerning growth? Well, we got two opinions here. Keynesians believe in macroeconomic policies of stimulating demand. And I've mentioned this several times. You know, the whole idea behind Keynesian economics is that as long as we can manage demand, we can manage the economy. And how do you manage demand? Well, there are many ways to do that, but ultimately it leads to a larger role for government. All right. Whereas Austrians believe in microeconomic policies to encourage saving and private investing to promote growth. See, would an Austrian be in favor of government policy that has led to below market interest rates? See, an Austrian would not agree to that policy. An Austrian would not agree to the Federal Reserve keeping interest rates close to zero, especially when those interest rates are below interest rates that would exist in a free market. Whereas Keynesians have reasons to justify that policy. Okay, but there's two different ways of thinking here. There's the Austrian way of thinking, and there's the Keynesian way of thinking. Now, to emphasize these different opinions is different government law acts In 1946, the federal government was mandated to do everything in its authority to achieve full employment. Period. 1946, the government said the federal government said, it is our responsibility to arrange the government affairs so that we have full employment. And then we're going to set goals to achieve full employment. You know, I mean, this may be obvious to you, but what I'm saying here is that before 1946, this was not the unofficial goal of government. I mean, before 1946, the government had other roles, but officially, people did not look to government to achieve full employment. All right? But in 1946, though, it became official that, hey, this is a role of government, that government should do what's necessary to ensure full employment. Well, that didn't exist before 1946. At least not officially. What were the objections to the Full Employment Act of 1946? Well, then you got the Austrians come along and say, well, if you're going to set a goal to always have full employment, then that negates the natural business cycle. That life is a series of ups and downs. That you know, you're going to have bad times and you're going to have good times, and you're going to have booms and you're going to have slumps. I mean, that's just the natural flow of the way things are in life. See, so the Austrians are saying, well, if you're going to try to force the system to full employment, that's unnatural. Now, again, which is right? You know, who's right and who's wrong? Well, I'm not saying, you know, Keynesians are right or Austrians are right. I'm simply trying to point out to you that there's a difference of opinion here. All right? The other objection that Austrians have to government mandate, you know, taking the responsibility of ensuring full employment is that there are lag effects. Now, the lag effects is there's always the... Let's say we have a problem. Well, it takes time for the government to recognize that we got a problem. And then it takes time for the government to decide what to do about the problem, which we call the decision lag. Now, especially in America, you know, we've got 535 members of Congress, we've got two different parties, we've got, you know, president. To get things done in Washington, D.C., we need, some cooperation. Well, you know, with such differing opinions, that could take a while. See, that's called the decision lag. Oh, we got a problem. What should we do about it? Well, we got to debate it, and we got weigh the pros and cons of this policy and that policy, and that takes a while. And then even after we decide what to do, it takes time for us to implement what we've decided to do, and that's called the action lag. And so what Austrians are saying is that, well, because of all these lag effects, government policies are always getting... I mean, if we had a dictator who was all knowledgeable and had all wisdom, what Austrians say is that then the government could make things better. But the fact is that we have insufficient knowledge in terms of our leaders, and we have a democratic system which is slow in making decisions and implementing actions. So if you look at the reality of the situation, then these goals of government can be counterproductive rather than proactive. And another difficulties that Austrians point out is that there's a difficulty in forecasting. We're running out of time, aren't we? Difficulties in forecasting, that that in order to make correct decisions, we've got to know exactly, you know, that if we do this, that this will be the result. Well, you know, that's in such a big, complex economy, that's not so easy. I mean, if we take this action, what effect would this action have on the economic system into the future? Well, you know, that forecasting is not a simple thing. So anyway, I can't finish it, but you can catch the rest. You know, I've almost finished this chapter, but I'm going to maybe recap a few things next time. But this does finish chapter 2. So what are y'all going to do for next time? Read chapter 3, right? So we'll get in chapter 3 next time. Anyway, I'm not going to hold you any longer, so I will see you next time.